in Germany, there's a sense that things have leveled out, that the worst is over. I think there is increased liquidity out there, and I think that that both reinforces a sense of normalization.
Welcome to the Alter Group podcast on real estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Today, our guest is John Levy, European analyst with the Eurasia Group, the world's leading global political risk research and consulting firm. John is a frequent commentator on European issues on CNN, CNBC, and NPR. He was previously director of national security policy for the John Kerry presidential campaign. John, I want to ask you about the search for liquidity in the American real estate market, and specifically how that relates to European investors, particularly Germany, which has now become one of the most aggressive investors in U.S. real estate behind only Australia. According to a recent report by CB Richard Ellis, German open-ended real estate mutual funds are expected to invest up to 12 billion euros in real estate both in Europe and the United States over the next couple of years. That's about 47 open-ended funds, and they've raised about 3 billion euros in the first 8 months of this year. So the simple question is, why Germany and why now?
I think some of this probably reflects a kind of sense of normalization in terms of credit and liquidity crisis. I wouldn't necessarily opine that that's an accurate assessment, but I think this is partly just anecdotally. I think that in Germany there's a sense that things have leveled out, that the worst is over, that government actions have had a stabilizing effect. I think there was certainly a pretty dramatic flight from the U.S. And from sort of external exposure. I think there's a little bit of a sense of a moderate increase in risk appetite, but some of that I think is really sort of a reversion to the pre-crisis mean. The second point that I think is probably important is that you've had pretty dramatic liquidity increasing operations in the Eurozone. The banks have obviously benefited from pretty tremendous ECB action. So I think there is increased liquidity out there, and I think that that both reinforces a sense of normalization and to create some additional cash out there that needs to be placed.
Now, John, if you look at their investment strategy, I would characterize it as being a core plus value add focus. If you look at a company, for example, like Deka Immobilien Investments, they've been purchasing Washington, D.C. office buildings, logistics centers in Prague. These are really prime properties and prime locations. So what can we glean from that? Does that reflect a sort of cultural bias towards sounder investments as opposed to opportunity plays?
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I think there is a sort of anthropological element to it. And I think what that reveals is a bias to steady income, a very strong bias against bankruptcy or default risk of any sort, whether it's on securities, whether it's on assets that are going to come into very distressed situations. And I think that extends to something of an aversion to participating very aggressively in distressed markets. Second, again, given the broad retail exposure and sort of small business exposure and even the culture of German banking and sort of I think that extends to the asset management world, I think you do continue to have some of this relatively conservative bias, again, a sort of view of real estate almost akin to what you might see in investors in sovereign debt, but obviously with a little bit of additional yield there. I think that very much does draw on a sort of investing culture which has very deep and specific roots, and I don't think is something that is necessarily likely to shift. There is certainly, another component of investing culture is real concern and aversion to of inflation, and I think a sense that real estate as an asset class is a very useful and appropriate hedge against inflation. Inflation contributes to this as well, to the degree that sort of feeds in with this other bias towards sort of quality and income producing streams. I think that there is a sense that you almost get a kind of automatic due diligence if you're really looking at high-quality assets. You have a track record with these assets. You know what the markets are going to be like. So I think that is consistent with some of these views.
John, I want to turn it around and talk a little bit about U.S. investors and opportunities in Europe. It seems like, based on the numbers I'm seeing, that the U.S. side has sort of abandoned Europe to some extent. Its investment is now down about 98%. from about 20 billion euros in 2007 down to 400 million in the first half of 2009. Give me a sense of what the trends you're seeing.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think one, clearly liquidity and credit availability issues that are behind some of this and just some of the risk tolerance as well. Two, you may see some currency effects in there insofar as the very strong euro has obviously had an effect on the yields that you can realize as an American investor. And at the same time, if you're an American holder of real estate and you need to undertake some dispositions, either given losses you might have seen elsewhere, credit constraints, and so forth, these actually may be some of the assets that in terms of price have held up better. I mean, the German markets have been more static. Again, even if you got some currency tailwind on a sale in a more depressed market, that might make such a sale a little bit more attractive. Those are a couple things that come to mind. I don't think that there is a kind of long-term bias away from U.S. interest in investment in Europe. And I think that one of the developments that you might see over the next few years, if you look at the sort of return on capital drivers in Europe, in the Eurozone versus the U.S., you may actually see some higher yields that can be realized in Europe. And then I think that goes across asset classes. So we might see another sort of burst of attractiveness. But I think in the near term, there are certainly some factors that would sort of cut down on the interest or the ability to undertake deals in Europe right now.
Now, John, we're speaking on the eve of a major election, but for the benefit of a prospective investor in Germany, give us a sense of the political landscape. They have a coalition government between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats with a junior partner, the FDP. Give us a sense of what people should know about the political climate.
It's a good question. This is a very unique political situation in Germany, as it has been over the last 4 years, where you've had a grand coalition led nominally by the Christian Democrats and Chancellor Merkel, but supported by the Social Democrats. And one of the things that's been so interesting about this is it's really resulted in a sort of, to borrow the kind of British and U.S. term, a third way in politics, where you've seen something that really melds together elements of the centrist elements of the center-right and the centrist elements of the center-left. This is important because that's really what's been behind some of the significant interventions that the government has taken, but at the same time, it's really supported a very strong consensus for fiscal consolidation. I think one of the reasons we've seen such limited fiscal stimulus in Germany is, one, a real concern about what that would look like in terms of budget, and two, a sense that the real risks, and as you alluded to, are in the banking sector, in some of the major firms that are going to have trouble in refinancing and continuing operations, and a preference, therefore, to actually use direct government intervention, whether it's loan guarantees or, in some cases, more aggressive intervention, to support the financial sector and to support key firms. I think one of the other issues underpinning the lack of stimulus has been a sense that there are increasing contingent liabilities in the banking sector, not really having a firm grasp on what the end cost to the state is going to be of all these workouts and restructurings. The political variable comes into this. There are two main options of what the coalition looks like. One is that it continues as is, in which case I think we see pretty much similar policy, though I think we'll start to see a little bit more pressure on the budget and the deficit widening after 2 or 3 years' time. If you see a majority right, center-right government, which means that the CDU would be able to form a coalition with the Free Democratic Party, mm-hmm. then you see a lot more pressure coming for tax cuts. That has a similar effect on the budget, but it actually might create some more interesting opportunities, certainly in the corporate space there. I don't think that you're going to see more stimulus under any scenario in the sort of traditional fiscal stimulus, but I do think you're going to continue to see political actions undertaken to support key firms. And when you look at the banking sector, I think there has been a lot of effort, for instance, to restructure some of the Landesbank and some of the other elements of the banking system. There's still a lot of entrenched opposition to that, particularly at the state level. I think it's still very, very politically difficult, and I think that suggests that we're still going to see a very long, arduous process in terms of cleaning up some of the banking balance sheet. So I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to see a radical restructuring of the German banking sector, but I think we are still going to continue to see the state intervening fairly aggressively, though if you see a center-right government, perhaps you get a little bit more pressure to push some of these banks to dispose of some of these assets in a sort of market environment.
Now, of course, to some extent, what happens in terms of German economic planning is mandated by the EU, which stipulates, for example, a 3% or lower budget deficit for all of its member countries. Give us a sense to what extent the EU is really a player in what happens in Germany.
This is always an interesting topic because the EU has enforcement powers, but a lot of the ability to actually see results is still dependent on a sort of opaque alignment of political interests. And in fact, if you look at the budget consolidation that we saw in the EU between 2005 and 2007 and into the beginning of 2008, which was pretty dramatic, it was really led by this German attempt to bring down a deficit that was over 3% in 2005 and went to effectively zero. And that had a kind of multiplier effect on the ability of the European Commission to get similar reductions achieved throughout the EU and throughout the Eurozone. Because I think we're now going to see a shift away from that position, a gradual shift in Germany, that actually, I think, undercuts the ability to see fiscal consolidation anywhere in the Eurozone. I think in Germany, the impact is likely to be relatively limited. I can't imagine any intentional move over a 3% deficit, which is what the EU allows. But I think in other countries, you could actually start to see much larger deficits being run, in large part because the German sort of leading by example is taken off of the scene.
Now, I want to ask you about the UK briefly, where we've seen a lot of commercial real estate loans go into default. There's about, it's estimated that about $350 billion is needed in order to refinance these loans, and we've seen property values decline by about 44% since 2007. Now, we're starting to see some positive signs in the third quarter numbers. Property values have increased 1.5%, and the weak pound is attracting investors from Europe and the United States. But give us a sense of what's been happening in the UK and to what extent are their problems related to the fact that they put all of their eggs in the financial services basket?
Yeah, I think that very high correlation, obviously, with financial services industry. And interestingly enough, I think that the centrality of the financial services industry and the City of London in the broader UK economy is a tremendous challenge to the UK's ability to deal with the losses that have been incurred in that industry, the shakeouts in employment and the obvious implications for space needs and the ability of firms to take up new projects. So I think that the leasing pool has been dramatically reduced in the City of London. You clearly, I think, are going to continue to see some consolidation in the banking and the asset management industries. The government is obviously dealing with major implications on the tax side of what this means, but there's an underlying structural challenge in the UK, and I think this is akin to what you see in a number of other economies in Europe, where you've either seen tremendous increase in the relative economic weight of real estate or finance in the overall economy, and this is something of a contrast from Germany and France and some of the other countries, particularly in sort of Central Europe. In the UK, you are going to see some very tough choices facing the next government, whether it's another Labour or it's a Conservative government, in terms of undertaking policies that try to reduce the overall share of financial services. I think there is a pretty strong emerging elite view that they do need to diversify the UK economy. Now, I don't think that's going to mean the City of London goes away by any stretch, but if it on the one hand you have a market-driven consolidation going on and a sort of slow return to the overall size and scope of the activities of the city, and at the same time you may see some government activity intended to sort of rebalance the economy a little bit, perhaps boost manufacturing, perhaps boost agriculture, and so on and so forth, you see a couple of concurrent factors that I think suggest that we're not really likely to see a return to the sort of status quo anti-crisis particularly quickly.
John, I want to ask you about some of the newer economies in Europe, in particular Eastern Europe. To take Poland, the largest economy in that region, 40 million people, it's been one of the least affected by the recession in relative terms. They're poised to enter the euro in 2012. Now, a couple of interesting statistics, 97% of the transactions there were in the office sector, and most of those were with German investors, about 78%. In addition to that, the sale leaseback market has been extremely active. So give us a sense of what we need to know about the Polish economy.
I think I think one of the things in Poland that some of the reasonably robust growth numbers may mask is a little bit of the kind of underlying risk that you have in a lot of the lending space in terms of the foreign exchange denomination of about 25% of loans, both household and commercial, and some of the currency effects. So you have had some pretty dramatic credit and liquidity tightening that's happened in Poland, as it has in most of Eastern Europe. That said, you do see a relatively diversified economic base. You see a country that has strong agriculture, strong manufacturing. A lot of its industry, and this obviously reflects the tremendous weight of that German FDI, is very closely integrated into the German economy and specifically into actual German firms. You have a lot of Polish firms that might have become subsidiaries of German firms, are basically contracted for all of their output, which is taken up by German firms. I think the existence of those links gives it a little more longevity. There's a little bit less sort of cyclical factor. So there's a bit of a smoothing effect. And you see that similarly in places like the Czech Republic, that's highly integrated with the German economy. If you look at the long-term outlook for a place like Poland, and I think in varying degrees this spreads across Eastern Europe, I think it's very positive. I think you do continue to see a convergence trend in terms of asset prices, in terms of wages, in terms of general wealth. You are at some point going to see all of these countries join the Eurozone. That's going to have a pretty dramatic effect on the credit and liquidity side, and I think really provide a pretty significant catalyst. That could be something that's 2 or 3 years off, but we are moving towards that. So I see in what's happened in Eastern Europe over the last year and some of the volatility, I see a tremendous number of risks in terms of refinancing and in terms of the potential to see defaults both in the household sector but also in the office and retail sector. But I think there's also some pretty dramatic long-term drivers, and I think that clearly the yield opportunities there are going to be much more significant than they have been and much more significant than they will be going forward. So I think that this crisis does present some pretty interesting opportunities throughout Eastern Europe.
And the preponderance of the office sector in Poland, do you think that's a reflection of all of the offshoring of business processing and backroom operations from higher-cost labor markets like Western Europe and the U.S. to places like Poland?
Yeah, I think one of the areas where a lot of Eastern European countries, and Poland is no exception, have been successful is starting to get, have their service industries much more deeply integrated into the European industries. In some cases, that's sort of outsourcing of business processing, but in many cases, it's also sort of organic growth of the service industries. And I think the labor cost advantages are dramatic. I mean, what you're paying for accounting or processing services or management even services as well in Poland is going to be significantly lower than what you see in Western Europe. You've also had a pretty significant sort of Europeanization of almost all European business, and that includes certainly the services industry, but also management components of local subsidiaries. So I think that there is a sort of growth in the office segment of any economy, even if it's as industrial as the Polish economy is. On top of that, you do have relatively limited space. You have I think competition for some of the really really prime office buildings. Just there are a number of buildings out there that are sort of aged. They may or may not be worth fixing up, but I think that there's still a pretty significant competition for really prime space.
John, one of the factors that anybody doing business in Europe over the long term, I think, needs to be aware of is the declining population. And it is right now at about 11% of the world's population, about 731 million. But by 2050, that's projected to drop to about 7%. There's definitely issues with aging populations, but also a negative growth rate. So give us a sense of how you think that's going to shake out, and what are some of the things that might help to ameliorate that?
There are a couple of big variables on this, and unquestionably this is this signals the onset of a pretty dramatic shift in how the European economy works, what the European social structure looks like, even the sort of ethnic makeup of the population. you know, I think that certainly you see pretty dramatic immigration, which can obviously offset some of these risks as you see, you know, sort of younger immigrants coming in and sort of evening out the dependency ratio factors. Now, that's politically fraught and contested in some countries more so than others, and I would argue that the countries that are sort of more socially and politically positioned to be open to immigration and to create an environment that does not result in sort of hostility that leads immigrants to leave are probably going to be better positioned. You also see an unprecedented degree of freedom of movement within the European Union. You've seen pretty dramatic shifts from Eastern Europe into Western Europe. Now, some of that is sort of temporary and correcting as employment opportunities fall off in Western Europe. What's interesting about this is you really start to see Eastern Europe actually face some real challenges. I mean, in some of the countries in Eastern Europe actually have a worse ratio in terms of aging population to younger workers. And in Eastern Europe, it's almost universally more difficult to deal with immigration coming from outside of Europe. So if you look at countries like Romania or the Czech Republic, I think the question can become a little bit more complicated, and if you take this out over the long term, then even in a place like France, where you clearly have very tense migration politics at the margins, but I think it's a society that is much better prepared to deal with migration. Second point is going to be how much of a shift in productivity, in the sort of type of value add do we start to see in parts of European industry. If we start to move away from some of the labor-intensive manufacturing practices, if we start to see more offshoring and so forth, you know, for instance, what we see in the German economy is a lot of production done domestically, but obviously some production being moved offshore, and I think we'll continue to see that trend. This could start to get around some of these issues and sort of change the overall equation. Now, from another perspective, if you look at this as, you know, how big is your population, what are the sources of domestic demand, and as you point out rightly, there's certainly an advantage in the U.S., and I think the structure of the U.S. economy and the relative importance of domestic demand in the U.S. relative to Europe is fairly clear. I don't see anything that leads to a real shift in what the demand picture looks like. For instance, for a country like Germany, I think you continue to see demand for German output is really driven by global markets, and it's not driven by the domestic economy. And I think the population trends suggest that that's going to remain in place.
Well, John, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure.
To listen to more Alter Group podcasts or to read our Alter Now blog, visit www.altergroup.com.